The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 527 for Sunday, November 9th, 2014. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, cool stuff found, and tips. We answer your questions, we share your cool stuff found, and we answer your tips by sharing them. And we all try to learn several new things each time we get together. Your sponsor for this show, our sponsor for your show, is Gazelle. Gazelle.com, the place where you can go and send all of your used Apple devices and turn them into cash. We'll talk more about that and more in the show here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And here in Durham, New Hampshire, it's Pilot Pete. Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, we got a threesome going today. This is a good thing.
Oh, boy.
Hey. That's better than John starting the show in pre-show. John was showing me a new anonymized social service. And so we had a pre-show chat about the random topics we found in this Yik Yak social service. You found Muslims, the Brits, bisexuality, and butthurt atheists. That is what you missed by not attending MacGeekGab.com/stream, which is where you get all of the pre-show conversation.
But it's localized, so I don't know what's up with you people up in New Hampshire there.
Oh, Durham. Boy.
Yeah. And, oh, look at that. So we just added a fifth group to either identify with or offend. So that was perfect.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Just in case we didn't have all the bases
just pull
covered.
Pull the pin on that grenade, John, and roll it right under the tent.
For
that.
Right. Oh, I think the grenade was already rolling. Yeah. Well, I don't think there was any risk in that. All right. Let's go straight into some questions here and see if we can get this show on track. I was going to say back on track, but that is we have yet to be on track. But that's okay. We're only 2 minutes in. So John, take it away.
Ah, well, let's start off with Andy, because I learned something new, which is always fun. So Andy from Scotland here. And he says, quick question. I have upgraded my iOS devices to 8.1 and Mac to Yosemite and opted in to iCloud Photo Library Beta. I know that a new Photos app is expected in the new year. But in the meantime, is there any way for me to add lots of existing photos to the service via my Mac? And at first, Dave, I thought the answer was no.
Yeah, I thought it was no.
Because the only way I thought you could add it was, well, I tried. So the thing is, so there is an FAQ, which we'll post that talks about it and basically says, well, you know, if you're on a Mac, then you're going to have to wait for the new Photos app in order to interact with the iCloud Photo Library. You cannot with existing programs, because I tried it, Dave. I tried it with Aperture. I tried to put it into, my photo stream. And although Aperture can consume the contents of iCloud Photo Library, and I guess iPhoto as well, it cannot submit things. Once you make the leap, you're kind of out of luck on the Mac side. Or so I thought, but then I poked around online and
I'm going to interrupt right for a moment, because I thought that anything that your Mac synced to PhotoStream also then was included in iCloud Photo Library. Is that not true?
I tried manually submitting a photo with Aperture to PhotoStream, and I did not see it on my iOS devices. So my conclusion is that, once you make they're somewhat separate. You can still consume the contents on a Mac,
right?
But you cannot submit contents.
Yeah. Okay. I thought the automatic syncing to PhotoStream from your Mac automatically pumped it into iCloud Drive, or iCloud Photo Library. But clearly, based on your testing, that is not true. So, all right, moving on.
Correct.
Okay.
However, I did a little poking around online, and I found an article. I think it was from our friends at iMore and our buddy Peter. And apparently they discovered, along with some others, that you can do it through the interwebs or through a browser.
Okay.
But there's a trick. So if you log into iCloud, but you have to do it in a special way. So if you log into iCloud, you will see photos, and it has a little beta across it, and you can see the contents of your stream there. But you can also submit, but here's the trick. You have to log into beta.icloud.com. Not regular. If you log into the regular and you go to your photo stream and you look at moments, you will not see an upload choice. But if you log into beta.icloud.com and then you go to your photos and look at moments, you will then see an upload option. So there is a way.
Nice. Oh, so, yeah, this totally works.
It's kind
works.
Of clunky. So the thing is, there is, as of yet, no piece of software on the Mac that will do it, but you can do it through a browser.
Yeah, so no dedicated clients, but yeah, okay. Huh.
Do you need to enable iCloud Drive or something? Because I don't have a photos option. I went to the beta.icloud.com.
Have you not enabled iCloud Photo Library?
I bet I have on
your phone
my
yet?
iOS. Yeah, because I was waiting to upgrade to Yosemite. And I'm sorry, to Yosemite, on my laptop.
Yep.
Which I just did last week.
So. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's
what it is.
Okay. Yeah, you gotta kick that on. Yeah. Good find, man. That's awesome. I had no idea that was there. And while we were talking about it, I did it right here. So I don't know if that was a good thing or not. I don't know if that was smart.
Uh-oh.
It seems to have worked out. Yeah, that's right. Uh-oh. Yeah. Hey, so Pete says, so that's as good an opportunity as any to talk about what happened last week, right, John? So, I mentioned that during the show, I was not doing the show from the iMac. I was doing it in front of the iMac, but the iMac was dead. Could not get it to start. You surmised, likely correctly, that it was a power supply issue. After the show, John, I immediately left, actually went to a hockey game because that's what we do on the weekends with a 12-year-old son that plays hockey. And then when we got back from the hockey game, I figured, well, let me come up to the studio and see what I can do. And this was something I discovered literally 30 minutes before we recorded the last show, right, John? So I didn't have a whole lot of time to diagnose. So I came up here, and what would happen and did happen after we got back from the hockey game is, John, I would turn it on with the switch on the back of the iMac, 2007 iMac, and it would begin to start up. Sometimes I would get a chime. Sometimes I would get half a chime, but it wouldn't really go any further than that, and it would immediately shut back off. This was not good. And then for some reason, I decided to hold the power button in. And I held the power button in for 10 seconds. After about 5 seconds, something odd happened. I had a very long beep, after which the computer started up totally fine. Now, you did some digging after I told you this, and you figured out what this sounded like, right, John?
I did.
You did?
I did.
You did. Do you remember what you found? You found an article that detailed this being both the process and the sound and results that one would get after telling the computer by holding the button in to complete a firmware upgrade. Now, to my knowledge,
the beeps. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. To my knowledge, there was no firmware upgrade pending on this machine. Now, that could be wrong. Maybe there was one years and years ago that never finished. But that, so then it started up, and immediately, as soon as it started up, I did a fresh clone of the drive, because that's what you do. And I managed, there was one bit of data. I mentioned that our QuickBooks data wasn't quite synced the way I want, so I changed that. Now I'm syncing that actually amongst multiple machines here using BitTorrent sync, and that's working really well. BitTorrent Sync is awesome, by the way. For those of you that haven't checked it out, it's like Dropbox without the need for a server at all, right? So it just is a peer-to-peer syncing. Now, if you have something like a Synology or some box. Maybe you've got a Mac Mini server. You can certainly run any one of the clients full time, and then you always have something to sync with. But it's just client syncing. So unlimited storage, or you're not paying monthly for storage. It's limited by the amount of storage that you have on whatever devices you're syncing with. But it works great, and it works on your local network. It works over the internet. It's magic because it's using the BitTorrent protocol, which is already very robust in that way. So I highly recommend checking it out. So that's my aside. Anyway, I got that all that worked out. I got the thing cloned, and then I shut the computer off because I had to know if this was a one shot deal or if it was going to be fine. And I shut the computer off. I left it off for a minute. I turned it back on. Everything was fine. I let it sleep overnight, which then of course did another clone. It was fine. Came back in the next morning. Totally fine. Lisa came up to start doing work. In the meantime, because I knew I had to fly out to Mac Tech Monday, I set her computer at home up so that she could work entirely from there if things didn't work. But they did, and she was fine. And then at about 10:30 on Monday morning, I get a text from Lisa saying, the iMac just shut off. That was it. No warning, no fanfare, just everything's happy, go lucky, and now nothing on the screen, no lights. Zilch. Came up. Couldn't even get it to chime. There was nothing. So I went on eBay, John, and for $30, I ordered a power supply because that's what you do. I had to know. I also started thinking about how nice it would be to have a Retina iMac in my office and take the 27-inch iMac from the office and put it up here, which is still in the back of my mind. I might try to wait until those are on refurb because why not, right?
Any week now.
What's that?
Any week now.
Any month now, probably.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But not before Christmas.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, probably not. That's probably true. So I got home from Mac Tech, which I want to talk about too. My daughter and I, because this is the machine we take apart together, we took this one apart and popped in the new power supply, which was a relatively simple operation given how many times we've been in and out of this machine. Likely, maybe part of the reason the power supply would have died, moving all that dust around. Yeah. Yeah. Although the power supply is fairly well protected when you're in there, but anything's possible. Right. So who knows? It's also a 7-year-old machine. So it's that alone. And I'd had a moment as I was drifting off to sleep one night at Mac Tech that, wait a minute, you know, what is there a PRAM battery in this iMac? Is that all that's going on? Is that thing dead? And so we did replace the power supply, but I chose not to fully honor the troubleshooting process, John. And on my way out of this machine and in closing it up, I saw the PRAM battery right there and I replaced it with a brand new one because I happen to have a brand new CR2032. And I learned something. Those quarter size batteries, you know, John, the CR2032s that we all use, the 3-volt mm-hmm. ones. So I had one that was labeled a DL2032. And I looked at all the markings on it, 3 volts, everything seemed the same. And so I did a little search, and the DL2032 is simply Duracell's branded model name for their version of a CR2032. So while you need to be very careful in not, there are a lot of batteries that are that same size. Some are even 12 volts, right? I mean, it's not.
That'd be bad.
That'd be bad, right? You got to be really careful. But in this particular scenario, the CL2032 or the CR2032 and the DL2032 are interchangeable. So I replaced that too, which I know I shouldn't have done if I were going to honor the process, because now I don't really know what solved it. In a sense, I don't really care, but I sort of do, because I have another one of these machines, almost exactly the same vintage and machine over in the house as the kind of the house iMac. And so if it were the battery, I kind of would want to know that to replace that battery. But I'll replace that battery next time I'm in that machine, no matter what, at this point. And I think it's a good process, because it's really simple to do once you get the screen off. But the biggest pain in the neck with these computers is putting the screen back on. Because what you do is, in order to do anything on these, you've got to, you literally put suction cups on the screen and pull the screen off. And there's actually two screens. There's the actual screen, and then there's this glass that goes over it. You're pulling the glass off with the suction cups, and then the screen, if you have to remove, which you do to get to the power supply, you don't if you if you're just doing the battery, you know, comes off with screws and all that stuff. But when you're putting all this back together, getting the dust off of the inside of the glass and the surface of the screen simultaneously is a big pain in the neck. And in fact, we did not succeed with this one. It's wintertime now, so it's a little drier in the house than it usually is. And B, where we did this in the kitchen is right next to Hector's cage. And we had just, I think the box that the power supply came in, we'd given to Hector because she likes to tear those kinds of things apart. So there was just dust everywhere in the air. But surprisingly, I'm not seeing anything that's driving me crazy on this screen. So,
no clean room for you, eh?
Not yesterday. No, but it is working. It has worked overnight. And if you're hearing this show and don't hear anything more about it during this show, then it worked fine throughout the show as well. So it was an interesting tour though, John. And, thank you for both the advice on the power supply and also the little heads up. I'm still really curious about this machine acting like it went through a firmware upgrade. That's sort of the head scratcher in all this.
Yeah, our pal Duffy ran into that once too.
Okay,
I think it may be if the power supply is getting wacky, it may corrupt the part of memory that holds the firmware. I don't know.
Sure,
because he ran into that too, and I'm like, yeah, oh, well, that this means you gotta apply a firmware or reapply a firmware update, and I think maybe that actually fix the problem. I had a problem with beeps too, Dave.
Go ahead.
Recently. Well, I just got a RAM upgrade here for, for my new refurb here because it only had 4 gigs and that's, kind of wimpy. So I wanted to get a 16 gig kit. So I ordered a 16 gig kit, Crucial, but I got it from Amazon and, it came, took the bottom off, took the old memory out, put the new memory in, start up the machine. Beep, beep, beep. I'm like, oh man, what did I destroy something? That's not good. So I'm like, okay. I grounded myself and, it was powered off and all that. I didn't disconnect the battery, which, they do recommend you do, but you don't have to. I'm like, huh, well, that's really weird. So, all right, put the old memory back in. Let's see if, I fried the machine somehow or it got fried. And
right.
It's like, nope, starts up great. I'm like, okay. Then I'm like, well, let's try to diagnose this. So I put one of the new 8 gig chips in. Beep, beep, beep. I'm like, oh, what the? Then I put in the other one, started up great.
Hey, that's good news.
Conclusion, one of the chips was bad. It happens. DOA. So, Amazon's real good about this, applied for a return. They gave me a shipping label, put it in the, put it in the UPS, local UPS box. They sent out a new one. Actually, it's funny because they got my return before I got the replacement, but got the replacement, popped them in and everything was wonderful. So,
hey, that's, oh, okay. So it really was two bad chips.
No, one bad chip.
One bad chip. Okay.
Yeah, I told you. So I took the new chips, put one in the machine, and it still gave me the three beeps. I put the other one in, and it didn't give me the three beeps. Therefore, one of the 8 gig chips was defective.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
It happens, even though, Crucial, makes good stuff. Who knows what happened? But, at first I was scared. I'm like, oh, man.
Well, that's the thing about RAM. I mean, first of all, most RAM comes with a lifetime warranty. And in fact, I wouldn't buy RAM that didn't. There's no reason it shouldn't because it's either going to be DOA or it's just going to work forever. And so there's no reason a company shouldn't offer a lifetime warranty on it. In your case, I guess unless you sat on it for years and years before you even tried to plug it in, it's either dead or it's not. So, well, that's good. I'm glad, man. So now you get 16 gigs in your MacBook Pro there, your new one.
Yeah, and I'm trying. Well, we'll post this article here, but I think, okay. Yeah, but three beeps means I don't like this memory.
Got it. I did have one thing I wanted to point out because, after I replaced this PRAM battery, I started the machine back up. And of course, it had been a week, right, since it had ran. And so it wanted to do its backups and clones and it needed to sync mail. And so, it's doing stuff and I see it going and I see the CPUs are at 100%. And that's, it's like, okay, well, that's what it's supposed to be, right? It's not disk bound because it's got an SSD in here. So it's doing what it's normally doing. Great. No problem. And then the backups finish and I'm seeing this process called RPC SVC host. And it's chewing up a lot of CPU. In fact, it's chewing up every bit of available CPU. So things are sitting at 100%. At first, I thought it was part of Carbon Copy Cloner. And then I realized, no, it has nothing to do with Carbon Copy Cloner. And I did some searching online. And I found
RPC, that... RPC, I think, is Remote Procedure Call.
Well, that's what I thought.
One thing that it means.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm actually, that may be what it means. But I saw quite a few posts about people finding that it was doing the same thing, sitting at 100% after or when their PRAM batteries died. And I thought, whoa, that's interesting. Did I put in a dead battery? And I know I didn't because I had actually just put this battery in a weird remote control for some speakers that I have. So I know the battery worked because the remote didn't work prior to replacing this battery. So I took it out. It wasn't quite brand new. It was maybe 3 weeks old, right? So in these things last year. So I wasn't worried about, the 3 weeks it sat and the one time I pushed the button causing any significant drain. But I did think, well, I did just replace this battery. Maybe the PRAM is just totally corrupted. So I reset PRAM on this machine, which is the same as it ever has been. As soon as you hear the startup chime, you hold down Command Option P and R and hold it down until you hear the startup chime again. So, of course, because I am a superstitious dude, I let that happen three times and then I let go. And it has been fine ever since. So if you ever see RPC SVC host running at full tilt, first thing to do is to reset your PRAM. But if you have no other reason to suspect why your PRAM got corrupted in the first place, then you may in fact have a bad battery inside the computer. So just figured, yeah, I'd throw that out there. Yeah.
Now, yeah. Interestingly enough, this machine, the MacBook Pro 2012, mm-hmm, does not have a backup battery.
Right.
How do I know this? Because when I installed the RAM the second time around, I disconnected, there's a connector from the battery,
yeah,
to the motherboard. And, per the recommendation, I just wanted to be safe. I disconnected it before I put in the memory.
Yeah.
And when I started the machine up, it said, dude, the date and time's wrong.
Right.
I actually get an alert from the OS and then quickly it fixed itself because I have a date and time set to go out to a time server.
Sure.
So initially it warned me,
yep,
that, yeah, this doesn't look right.
Yep.
But then it fixed itself. So, yeah, because I guess the...
So keep an eye on that because you may need to also just reset your PRAM.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because effectively you did the same thing I did. You removed the motherboard from its PRAM battery for some period of time, right? So I don't think am I wrong that saying that no Mac laptops have separate PRAM batteries these days?
Oh, they do.
Some do.
My 2008 did.
Really?
And boy, oh boy, you know where they put that? Oh man, what a nightmare.
Really?
They put it they put it under the DVD drive. It was such a freaking nightmare to get that thing out of there. Because I was running in the same problem is that, I'd take the machine off of power and then I'd start it up and it's like, 1990, whatever epoch. Yeah. It's like the date and time is wrong. And I'm like, so I looked online and actually bought one from iFixit. And it actually turns out it is I think it's one of those CR2032 batteries.
Same one. Okay. Yeah.
With a proprietary, connector.
Oh, you got to solder the connector onto the battery, right?
Yeah. The thing is, I bought one that was
pre-soldered.
It was kind of pricey.
Okay.
Yeah, I could have done it on my own, but that's basically what it was. But yeah, that machine had one, but man, it's like, and it was annoying because there was no way to read the status of it. There's no way on that machine that I could find out where you could say, hey, what's the voltage on that? Because normally with iStat menus and stuff, I mean, you can see all sorts of voltages, but that random machine, you know, when it dies, and there's really no way to know if that is the case.
I see no such sensor in iStat menus anyway on this machine for a PRAM battery either. So it may be that the computer just doesn't have that sensor. Right. I mean, you know. All right. Well, that's interesting. Fun stuff. I want to talk about, John, our first sponsor for today, which is Gazelle.com. You know, it's that time of year when you're getting your new iDevices, and maybe because new ones just came out, or maybe because you're going to be doing it as the holidays approach here. And so you're going to have an old one, potentially more than one old one, that is no longer of use to you. And that's what Gazelle specializes in. John, they will take that old device of yours and turn it into cash. But it happens in a, the businesses in my mind that succeed are the ones that reduce friction, right? So obviously there are many ways to take anything you own and turn it into cash. Some are obviously easier than others. And of course, if you're willing to take your old, 64 gig iPhone 5S and sell it for a buck, you can turn that into cash really, really quickly without a whole lot of friction. But you want more than a buck for it. And that's where Gazelle comes in, because they're actually going to give you real money for these things. So you go to gazelle.com. You can even do it with your old iPhone 5S. They've got a great mobile interface. They've got a great web interface. You go there, you tell them what you have, what size it is, if it's locked or unlocked, how, you know, that whole drill. And then they give you a price. If you like the price, they ship you a box. It's at that point that they ask you your name and your address too. You haven't given them anything other than what you have, so they can tell you what they will pay you for it. And if you like the price, they send you a box, and then you put the thing in the box. Still, they give you a shipping label. It's all free, right? You don't pay anything. They're the ones that pay for everything. They pay for the shipping. They pay for the box, and they pay you for the device. You can get it via PayPal. They'll send you a check if you prefer, or if you're willing to take it as Amazon bucks, which this time of year makes a whole lot of sense, because you're probably going to wind up spending some money on Amazon as we head into the holiday buying season. They'll give you an extra 5%. So why not? Just go that route. It's way easier. Take that. You'll have your money in a week. It's great. And a week included is really because they got to send you a box. You got to put it in the box. You got to send the box back to them at their cost. And then they give you your money. It's that simple, right there on Amazon. Good to go. They give you a little gift card. You apply it to your account. You're done. So this is Gazelle, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Now, John, people have asked us over the years, what does Gazelle do with all these things? And a lot of these things, they recycle them, right? And recycling can happen in a lot of different ways, but they do. They sell them off in bulk a lot of times too. They'll bundle up, all the 64 gig iPhone 5s that are unlocked, and, sell them in a batch at 100 or 1,000 at a time, and they get money out of it. And that's how they keep their business going, right? I mean, it's how they work. Well, now they'll sell these individually to you. They have what I like to call a CPO system, certified pre-owned. So they're going through these things as they do all the things that they get. And they are making sure that they work. They're polishing them up. They're making sure the software is right and all that good stuff. And then they'll sell them to you. And you can check that out at gazelle.com as well. So whether you're buying or selling or both for the holiday season or otherwise, go check it out. This is the place to get a phone and sell a phone.
That's cool.
It is cool.
That's new.
Yeah, it's new. I like it. I'm really stoked about this, actually. It was
cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad they don't throw them in a landfill or something.
No, they've never done that. No. Just to be
paying that kind of coin.
Yeah. I dug into a lot of. Right. Well, that's the thing. Yeah, they're paying good money. They're not just going to put these things. Yeah. They're turning them into cash for themselves. They're a business. Right. Yeah. I dug into quite a bit of their practices when they first signed on board with Mac Geekab. I wanted to make sure I understood it. And no, they're actually extremely responsible with all this stuff. In fact, by taking Gazelle's money for your phone, you're probably being more responsible with your phone than you would be had you kept it yourself. And eventually, you know, I'm going to save it. And then 5 years down the road, it's like, I'm just going to throw it away, you know, which is what happens with a lot of the old cell phones that you know, we wind up sitting on. So yeah, no, you're actually being responsible by taking Gazelle's money for your phone. So check them out. Gazelle.com. Good folks there. GAZELLE. All right, John, I'm going to move us on to what do we have next? Rick. Let's see. Let me find Rick. I wasn't perfectly prepped here. Rick writes, I have on my desk a 2013 27-inch iMac running Yosemite. The desktop has never left my house since being opened the first time. I also have a MacBook Pro 2010 laptop that I travel with extensively in the U.S., on my iMac, I recently opened System Preferences, Network Advanced, and to try to make sure my home network was the only wireless location that the iMac was trying to connect with. And lo and behold, there were dozens and dozens of locations listed in that dialog box. Upon review, I realized that all these locations mirror those that are on my laptop. So somehow the two machines are syncing wireless locations either one has connected to. And that is less than desirable for me, at least as far as I need my iMac to only connect to my home network. I did move my home network to the top of the list and wonder if I delete the rest of the locations, will they also delete on my MacBook Pro, which I don't necessarily want to happen. Should these lists be cleared every so often anyway? And why would something like network locations be synced anyway? So we have been seeing this for a while.
First, to be clear, he said locations. I don't think that's entirely accurate. Mm. Locations is something different.
You're right. You're right.
What he's seeing is SSI or base station names.
Correct.
If you go to network, Wi-Fi, advanced, in the Wi-Fi tab, you're going to preferred networks, I think, is what he really meant.
That's the right term. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah. So this will happen not only between your Macs, but also between your iOS devices. And this has been happening for a while. It's not a new thing with Yosemite. My experience with this is that it happens when you sync documents and data. I'm seeing some notes in the chat room. And I think, John, you had found some folks saying that it was, you know, if you're syncing iCloud Keychain, that is not my experience with this. That may be where it's moving to, and if it is, that's probably a good thing. But in the past, it has not been there. It's been documents and data syncing that caused this. And really, you know, that's sort of an all or nothing sync. If you want any of that stuff to sync, then you get all of it to sync. And it, that kind of drives me crazy. I mean, it's driving Rick crazy with his wireless networks. With me, just yesterday, I realized that I had all these inactive mail accounts on my computer. I'm like, oh crap. So I went into network. I tried to delete them from mail, and it's like, no, you have to go into System Preferences, internet accounts, and delete them from there. So I did. And I had two copies of my main email account. Well, after deleting those, this computer here in the studio had no copies of my main email account. And in fact, it deleted all of that mail data from mail. Now it's all IMAP and it's all synced, but I was like, okay. So then I added a new one to this computer and I changed the name of it, or I gave it a different name so that I'd know if it was, you know, duplicating. All my other computers inherited the new name with the account that they had previously existing. It's a big mess. And I don't see it getting any better. But
what's the purpose of that? Is it supposed to make it just work, you think? Is there some reasoning behind that?
Well, it's actually really handy. If you go somewhere and connect your laptop to a wireless network, and you have a password for it and all of that good stuff.
You go back, it reconnects.
Well, but it's really handy if your iPhone then also connects to that same.
Sure.
I mean, I get it. Yeah. I get it.
I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And Brian Monroe is emphatically telling me in the chat room here that he sees it in the keychain. That is not where it was in prior to Yosemite. It may well be there now in iOS 8 and Yosemite. That's entirely possible. And again, makes a lot of sense because that data, in a sense, should be secured. Although I think most of the iCloud data is secure. But yeah, no. Then previously it was not a keychain thing because we weren't syncing keychains.
Yeah,
and yet all this data was still syncing.
Because I just noticed, like, we were at a restaurant last night. I joined Wi-Fi on my iPhone. My laptop's never been there yet. There's the network.
Are you doing keychain syncing?
I'm not.
You're not?
No.
Really?
I don't have keychain turned on.
Let me see this. Hang on. I'm stealing Pete's computer here, folks. Yeah. So we're looking. I'm going to not apply whatever changes you just made, Pete, if that's okay. So I'm going into iCloud. Slowly but slowly.
Okay. If not slower.
If not slower. You do have keychain.
I didn't think I had the keychain enabled. My iCloud keychain.
Yeah, you do. You do. So it could be syncing in keychain. Again, I had always found it in just documents and data, which now is...
Oh, no worries. I get it.
All right. Which is there. So, yeah. No, it's...
Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't remember turning that on.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good thing to have on. I mean, it's a handy thing. Yeah. Whether it's in documents and data or keychain sync, it doesn't much matter. You're probably not going to want to turn either one off just to limit this functionality.
Yeah, well, you know, like you say, you know, in theory, it should be good. But,
that's right.
But boy, it can create a mess, I bet. And if something gets corrupt in there, stand by.
Yep. Yep. So, yeah. And I'm sure the mail stuff, I think the mail stuff is documents and data syncing that I'm finding. And you can dig around. It's also gotten harder to dig into this stuff, right, John? Because if it is a documents and data thing or now an iCloud Drive thing, right? If you go into, it used to be that you could go into your home folder, into library, and into mobile documents, and you would see not everything. Right. And all the file names would be really weird. They would have some thing approximating a UDID. Some of them would, or an app ID. And then you'd have a bunch of folders with com/apple/something. Right. If now on Yosemite, if you go into that folder, all you see are what I'll call humanized names of things, right? And are you on Yosemite on this machine?
I am.
Yeah. So if you go into the iCloud folder, which you can get to much easier now, but it's the same folder, you see humanized names, you see pages, numbers, keynote, right? If you go there,
I just turned it on. I had not turned on iCloud Drive. So
okay. All right. So it might take some time to see. Yeah. Yeah. But that's what you'll see there. However, all these other folders exist. And for me, the only way I've been able to go and muck with them now is with the terminal. I have to go and do it manually with the command line. I have to go to library mobile documents or home library mobile documents. And then you can see all these other things that live out here. But it's kind of a pain in the neck. And, you know, com/apple/mail, I think, is where, where your accounts and all that stuff get synced. Maybe. I don't know. It's all crazy. Yep.
Wow, yeah. Boy, that was fast to set up. But yeah, it's all right there. And like you say, and easy to remember names.
Yep. Yeah, well, it's nice, except it's you know, it's there. And it I mean, that last night, that was a big disaster for me. That's actually the disaster for me with mail is not over because it still was syncing my mail data when I woke up the computer this morning. Okay. And I didn't want it syncing mail data while I'm trying to podcast. We have enough troubles. So I had to quit mail. And at the end of the podcast, everybody that's in the chat room at macgeekab.com/stream, I'll say hello. But folks have been very helpful today. We'll have to deal with my machine hiccuping and burping because mail is now crunching in the background. So it's crazy.
And I'm going to do a quick segue on that.
Go.
Because one of the things you were shutting down when I walked in was Time Machine on this machine.
Oh, yeah.
And then I said, well, why aren't you using the Time Machine Editor, Dave?
Yeah.
And Dave said,
well, I was, and it got working oddly. So, John, have you updated Time Machine Editor lately?
Hello.
How long's John been gone?
I don't know.
No, it's still, I'm still running. It seems to work just fine.
Okay. So I realized that for me, it was not working well. And so when I had to rebuild this machine the other day, I just turned normal time or not rebuild, but I turned normal time machine back on. So I disabled time machine editor, which was and actually still is a great little piece of freeware that lets you set the schedule for time machine, but it wasn't working. So I just turned it off and then turned time machine's normal hourly scheduling back on and everything was golden, except I needed to then turn time machine off for the show. And Pete, as he said, why don't you use time machine editor? And I thought, well, it's not working. I thought, well, you know, I haven't updated that in several years. Let me check. So they're at time machine editor version 4, actually 4.02, which just came out in September. They have a new thing, John. So it used to be that you could set it by calendar intervals by saying, you know, a backup every Monday at 10 a.m. or whatever, or set a set interval where it would go every, you know, 6 hours, every 8 hours, whatever you were happy with. Well, now they have a new option in Time Machine Editor, John, and it is when inactive. And that's all the setting you need if you're going to use that mode. And it says Time Machine Editor will do its best to schedule backups when you are not actively using the machine. So I'm curious to see how that works, but that's a very fascinating little thing and worthy of a mention ahead of Cool Stuff Found.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's pretty good, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. 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 Sweet. All right, John, you want to take us to Michael since we were rambling and ranting about mail app and things getting accounts getting confused?
Michael, Michael's a mess, man. We're going to fix him up here. So here's what's happening with Michael. So he says, hi, Dave and John. I took the plunge and upgraded to Yosemite after ensuring all necessary backups were in place. The upgrade went well, and when the system came back up, the only problem I encountered was with Apple Mail. My POP3 account with O2 would receive emails without a problem, but I was unable to send them. When I looked at the settings, I found the SMTP setting was marked offline. See attached screenshot. I took the following actions, none of which resolved the problem. I checked the data was correct. I re-entered the data. I deleted the account and set it up fresh. Any help you can give me would be appreciated. Best wishes, Mike. And then he sent some screenshots, which is very handy because, Dave, I can tell you what the problem is here.
What be like the problem?
Said, it's a mess. So his screenshot showed 1, 2. So what happens is if mail can't send a message, which when you send, you're sending using something called SMTP, and mail maintains a list of SMTP settings, he had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 listed. Now, that's not good because he only has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 email accounts. And then they were all listed, and a number of them were listed as offline. And the thing is, he even selected one that said, and it was failing, but and it would say, you know, like O2 UK offline. Well, what does that mean? What that means is that for whatever reason, one of the settings, whether it be the server or the authentication method or something, something's not right. It ain't right, Dave.
Yeah.
So really what he had to do, and my recommendation, so it was pretty clear to me, again, looking at this list here, it's showing all of them offline, which means that at some point it failed to connect to it. He got very close because in that dialogue, you will see, you know, when it says can't send a message using the server, blah, blah, you'll see a list of them. You know, mail will first ask you, well, hey, you want to try a different one? But then there's a button, edit SMTP server list. And this is what he has to do. So he has some old cruft in there that he's got to clear out. So my recommendation is as follows. Go into edit SMTP server list. Clear out all the garbage in there. And then start anew and start adding. So, of course, when you go to edit SMTP server list, I'll do that right now. So and how do you do that? You go to mail. You look at your accounts. It'll show your mail accounts. Oh, that's not the right place. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's right. You have to dig into accounts.
Or here, preferences. So preferences. So here, there's a couple of ways to get to it. So okay. One is if it fails, you'll get an edit SMTP serverless. The other way is you can go to preferences and you'll see your accounts. And then there's a outgoing mail server list. And you can also say edit SMTP server list. So once you click on that button, you'll see a list of all your SMTP accounts. So what I would do in his case is get rid of all of them. There's a little minus button. I would basically clear all of them out and then add them, you know, check your settings, you know, verify with your ISP what the name of the outgoing SMTP server is, and that's in the account information tab. And then there's also an advanced tab, and what happens there is that's how mail is going to authenticate to that server. And typically, or at least the way I'm set up on this machine here, you know, there's one button which will indicate which port to use. So you probably want to say use default ports, you know, 25.465.587. SSL may be supported, and then there's the authentication method, and at least for me, it's for the ones that I use, it's password. And so you typically enter your username or your email account name and then the password for that account. And that should do it for him.
So I'm going to mention that ports list often... so it changed, right? In Yosemite, we now get a checkbox that says automatically detect and maintain account settings. And that does not show you the order in which it's going to check ports. In fact, it doesn't even mention ports specifically there, though clearly that's
look at that.
Part of account settings. Yeah. And even in Mavericks, that auto selection did not always work well. Depending on your mail server. So if it, most of the time you probably want to use port 465 and check the use SSL box and then use password authentication to connect to your mail server, your outgoing mail server. This is, so if it detects it, yeah, if it detects it and works automatically for you, great. But oftentimes it's not going to. This was actually, and this is really, and I will use this as a segue to talk about Mac Tech, but this was a dinner table conversation or one of the topics of a dinner table conversation on Thursday night where there were just a bunch of us sitting around. It could have been any table at this thing. And you know, there were 300 people there and every table would have been interested in, I think, in every conversation that any other table was having. But it's awesome to just immerse yourself with geeks for 3 or 4 days. You know, it's like all of us having a conversation all the time. It probably would get, I don't know if it would ever get old, frankly. I think I would love it all the time, but I certainly love it for the period of time that I'm at any of these shows. And Mac Tech is high on my list. Probably my current favorite show and probably frankly has been for years in terms of content and the people and just the vibe of it. They really do a great job. But yeah, that was one of the conversations we were having and somebody else brought it up. They're like, well, it doesn't quite, you know, work the way you expect it to. And we all were like, yeah, we know, you know, cause half support group kind of, and half informative. We actually had a long, engaging discussion about IPv6 at the table. In fact, it made me realize I should have done an IPv6 session at Mac Tech, and maybe I will propose that to Neil Tichton next year. Or any other show, because I think we all need to start using it. And it starts with us geeks, but we've had that conversation here. We just haven't had it amongst the geeks yet, or at least not those geeks. So, Mac Tech, it's always a fantastic show. The other thing that came up at that same dinner conversation, John, is another show that you and I really need to consider going to called Kansas Fest. We've talked about this a little bit. Do you know what I'm talking about with Kansas Fest, John?
No.
It is a show that happens in Kansas City, Missouri every year in July. And it is an Apple II festival. And it's as my friend, my new friend Ivan said to me, it's way better than you'd think it would be or that it even should be. But it will likely inspire anybody that intends to dig out or go and get their old Apple II and start messing around. But I've heard about this. I stumbled onto it about 5 years ago, and I was going to go. I even remember mentioning it to you, John, and for whatever reason, it's in July, which is a tough time to travel, especially for me, frankly, because, you know, that's when the kids are out of school and it's tough for me to be away during that period of time. But I'm going to put it again on my calendar this year in hopes that I can make it. And John, I think you would have a blast there too. I would think it would be a fun show for us to attend. So we got to check out, we got to keep an eye on Kansas Fest. So I wanted to recommend that to everyone here because, you know, there you go.
Well, they're having one in Australia in April, a Kansas Fest, K-Fest.
K-Fest, an Apple II festival?
Appears to be, yeah. Okay. But they wanted to have one down in Oz, too.
Okay, so, got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so they're franchising and expanding. Yeah. Isn't this crazy? Yeah. So somebody was telling me that there was a new peripheral made, a new board made for an Apple II, John. You would love this. So right now, if you go and download an Apple II emulator for your Mac, or probably even for your iPhone, if you can find one, you might need to jailbreak to do that. But if you download an Apple II emulator for your Mac or any computer, you then go and find ROM files, which really are just effectively images of the floppies that you used to insert into your Mac. And that's how you do it. You say, oh, I'm going to point, you know, slot 6 drive 1 at this ROM file and then boot that drive. And then it starts up from the disk. That's how the emulation works. You're not actually inserting disks into your Mac because there's no place to put them. Somebody created a board that you put into your Apple II and you put an SD card in, and the SD card has all these ROM files on it. And then on the board, you select which ROM file you want it to quote unquote load. And then when you boot your Apple II, it's actually loading from the ROM files on your SD card. But your Apple II only sees it. So your Apple II doesn't have to be able to address all the storage that's on your SD card, because that would be a huge trick. But the trick is it doesn't have to, the card does. And then the card, you know, basically translates it and makes it seem like a drive, and it starts right up. This is fun stuff, man. The fact that people are doing this with Apple IIs, I think a huge part nostalgic, but also a huge part just super geeky and fun. So
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. So on the airplane, John, I use Video Station on my Synology and DS Video on my iPad and iPhone to watch movies, right? But there's some movies that Video Station won't play the sound for, and that's always a pain in the neck. Plays it fine when I stream them to my Apple TV, but does not play the sound fine on my device. Well, I found another piece of software, John, and it's because the sound is encoded in a way that's not natively supported on the iPad. And there's a lot of video player apps that only will play sound and video, frankly, that's natively supported. It just basically is tapping into the default iOS framework for playing video. It says, go and play this file. And if iOS doesn't know what to do with the sound, it just, you get no sound and sorry, Charlie. Right. So, but it doesn't have to be sorry, Charlie. There have been apps over the years that have come and gone for various reasons. VLC used to be one of them. Maybe it still is, but it's always been kind of in flux, but that doesn't matter because Infuse and Infuse Pro are out. Infuse is amazing what they've done with this. It's from the folks at Firecore, right? So these are people that know how to find their way through things, which is really important. It's a gorgeous app. So the best part about Infuse, I don't know what the best part, the main part, I don't even know if I say the main part, one great part about Infuse is that it will play any audio type and pretty much any video type too, and any subtitle type for a movie. Now, it's also got a metadata loader. I can point this thing at my disk station, either with DLNA or with SMB or however I want to point it at it. It will attach to my Plex server on the disk station. It will attach to just the disk station itself, however I want to do this. and I can pull movies off of it. And the exact same movie file, it's not doing any transcoding on the way, it's doing it all on device. The exact same movie file that won't play inside the DS video app will play just fine inside Infuse. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it's got a nice library. It's got a nice picker. There's a couple things that make it doesn't have an easy way of searching that I've found. So you've got to kind of know what you're looking for and know how to find it. But once you find it, all the metadata comes with it and all that good stuff. And it's really, I mean, it's a gorgeous app. A lot of these kind of, I don't want to call them hacky apps, but the apps that prioritize being able to play video and audio that have come and gone over the years have never really had a great UI. Infuse is different. It has a killer UI, almost to the point, and perhaps it will get this way, so I don't have to deal with the headache. It'll become the app that I download and play all my videos with. But it's certainly one that I definitely need to keep on my iPad and my iPhone. So that was an interesting piece of interesting little find. Infuse 3 is what they're up to now. And yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. And I will segue that, John, unless you have any questions for me, into the fact that the iPhone 6 Plus on the airplane was an awesome thing to watch movies on. On the way out, I watched a movie on each. I watched one on the iPad mini and then one on the 6 Plus. Which is like an iPad mini mini. That's right. Yeah. And it was great. It really isn't. I didn't even notice that I was on a smaller device. It was totally fine. It fit on the ever shrinking tray tables on the,
I can't lean back and break your iPhone 6 Plus. No, it's small enough.
Cause finally. It's small enough. Yeah. It worked out really well. I was very impressed. And after traveling this week with it, I will never go with a phone smaller than this. This was awesome size.
Yeah. I finally broke down and ordered mine the other night.
Yeah.
I actually ordered, I'm AT&T, but I ordered a T-Mobile.
Cause
it's unlocked.
Yep. Yep.
Not doing the lock thing anymore.
Yeah. Well, right. So yeah, it worked great. The battery was great all week. This week I moved it into a Senna case. I had reached out to Senna to check out some of their cases. You know, I had that cheap $10 leather-esque Amazon case that I found on Amazon that was essentially a wallet kind of billfold thing that opens up and has credit cards on the inside and all of that. I reached out to Senna to test their case out. And so I tested their Heritage wallet book out.
I like that.
You know, so here's the thing, Pete, when I first got this case, I liked it. I put it on the phone and I thought, okay, well, this is nice, but you know, my Amazon case was $10 and this one's like 80, right? Yeah. I mean, so, you know, would I buy this? And it initially I thought, no, you know, it's, I'd buy 8 of the other ones before I'd buy one of these.
Sure.
And it was stiff and it was kind of weird and it doesn't have a flap to close it, you know, or a lock to close it, which I actually eventually found after about 2 days. They sent us one for the 6 and for the 6 Plus. So I put the one for the 6 on Lisa. She had exactly the same experience as me initially. I thought, wow, it's stiff. It doesn't stay closed. All this. After like 2 days, the leather starts to, you know, warm up a little bit. It closes. It softens up and it's awesome. And there's no way I want to take this thing off my phone.
it's beautiful though. Cause it's got a little clear window for your driver's license, but the ability to slide your thumb in there and slide it out. And
it's got a little pocket for cash. If you want to keep a little cash in there.
Now I know where you keep your cash.
That's right.
Jonesing for one of these, man. That's nice.
It's nice. Yeah. It really is. They've done a great job with it. The one complaint, and it's fairly protective of the phone itself around the edges, which I like. Sure. The one complaint I have is sometimes the leather is so soft that it doesn't stay up in what I call folio mode, where you put it up like where you'd want to tilt it up and watch a movie. That's my only complaint about it. Is that it's a little, the leather is actually too soft on the back and it folds a little much for me. It needs something to lock into. Sure. So that it doesn't slip. But
especially in turbulence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Right. But otherwise, very, very happy with it. So I figured I'd throw that out there too. Anything else? I got all kinds of things to mention, John, because there were all kinds of cool things that happened this week. So So I've got other stuff that's not really Mac tech related. Although I did take a Swift class, John. Have you messed with Swift at all?
Yeah, a little bit. It's a nice language.
Mm-hmm.
Better than Objective-C. I don't like Objective-C.
Yeah.
Brackets.
I never could quite wrap my head around Objective-C in a way that I liked it. I spend a lot of time in PHP, which is it's another curly brace language, right? You know, a descendant of C, if you will, or an offshoot of C, certainly. Its objectiness is a little weird, but from what I've told, it's similar to C sharp in that way. And Swift is similar to both of those, right? There's none of these weird brackets. It's very easy to, read. It's a little misleading as you dig into it. It does all this type inference stuff, which means that the type of your variable, you don't have to define it. Like if you set, a variable called name, the first thing that you assign to that, it will infer. If you assign a string to that, it makes it a string. If you assign an integer, it makes it an int. But it feels sort of loosey-goosey with its types, but it's actually way more strict than Objective-C with its types, because once the type of a variable is set, that shalt not change. And it gets really weird if you start trying to mix variable types. So you really inference is great because it makes the code easy to read and it makes it cleaner. But you darn well better know what you've done with these variables, because later on you need to know what the types are. So that part was interesting, but I really liked it. I found it very comfortable, especially, spending all my days in PHP working on stuff for the back end of TMO and for all the MGG stuff and all that. So I was very impressed. I took the class with Simon Allardyce, he's actually an on staff trainer at Lynda, and does a lot of programming classes there. So they're not a sponsor of this particular episode, but they are a long-term sponsor of Mac Geek Cab and still are. So
fundamentals of programming is amazing.
And he's a great guy. Yeah. Lynda.com/MGG. If you want a 7-day free trial, and that's a bonus mention for the Lynda folks, but Simon did a killer job. He really, yeah. Yeah, his fundamentals of programming is one I actually want to take now.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I went through that.
Yeah, I
love it.
Yeah. So, what else we got, John? I got all kinds of things. Did you see that Amazon Prime members now get to back up all of their photos for free, unlimited?
Oh, that's nice.
I know. They got a little iOS app that'll take care of all that for you. Amazon Cloud Drive, I think it's called. So that's a good thing.
I do that with Dropbox. At least for my iPhone.
But it's not free. I mean, it's not unlimited.
It is for me.
But Dropbox isn't unlimited. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, yeah. Amazon is. But just good.
Well, we'll see how long that lasts. Because actually, who is it? Yeah, I had uncool things found.
Yeah.
Bitkasa recently did some change on their back end.
Oh, yeah.
And it totally doesn't work for me anymore. It's like totally munged. They're like, yeah, we're doing, some sort of big whoop-de-doo upgrade in the back end, and you're going to have to resync your stuff. And I'm like, eh, all right,
Sure.
So, I got an email from them, clicked on a button, and it said, yeah, we're transferring or migrating your back end from, one to the other. And I'm like, okay. And tried to re-mirror. So they call it mirroring. Tried to re-mirror folders for my machine that used to work, and it would get to almost the end, and then it would say, yep, I'm almost done, 0 bytes remaining, and it would never finish, and it never appeared on their site.
Did you contact support?
I'll try.
Yeah.
But, hey, it's free, but they also abandoned their
unlimited
plan,
right,
which has some people shaking their fist because, one of their promises was, yeah, we got this infinite plan,
right?
If you pay a certain amount of money, now they cap it, but man, I didn't, I can't imagine what I did to screw anything up. I mean, I followed the directions, clicked on the migrate button, downloaded the latest version of their client on both of my machines here on both my Yosemite and my Mavericks machine, but it doesn't mirror anymore. Yeah, I'll try to contact.
Yeah, I'm curious.
I'm not paying. I don't have a paid program. I just have the freebie.
Right. But there's always something, you know, I tend to, given how much extra stuff I test and install and the tweaks that I do to my system, I tend to always give those kinds of things the benefit of the doubt, at least on one round through support, because it could very well be something that, you know, in this case, you've done on your machine that just makes it non-standard enough to get in the way of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I poked around other forums, and one suggestion was, delete the cache files. They maintain a cache somewhere, and I cleared that out. But I'll contact their support.
Yeah,
but,
curious.
Again, I'm not paying for it, so we'll see what happens.
Right.
But it was a fine replacement for SugarSync, which
So why are you bothering with all of these messy online services when you have a disk station there where you could use either CloudStation or BitTorrent Sync, frankly, and just do it that way and not have to worry about some third party mucking about with your life?
Well, I have my stuff in multiple places.
Fair enough.
So for example, I mirror certain things, like my documents folder, I mirror it to both Transporter and formerly Bitkasa.
Yep.
And now they're broken.
Yep.
No, I always like as we've pointed out in the past here, having one backup is not enough.
It's not enough.
So stuff that's important to me, just in the time machine and Dropbox, I'll put some stuff on Dropbox. I just like to, and just to be hip with, the services. But
yeah,
Bitkasa was pretty cool for a while, but now I'm sad. So I'll see if they can fix me up.
So Synology had an update this week, or has an update coming, I suppose. I think officially it comes out on Tuesday, but you can get early access if you want to DSM version 5.1. Which adds something I've been interested. It adds quite a few things, actually, but one thing that I've been interested in checking out for a while and just started playing with is they've added a completely new service. So they have Audio Station, where you can basically do your own local iTunes match thing. I mentioned Video Station earlier. Now they have, and there's a lot of other stations that they have too, they have added something called Note Station, which is effectively heading down the path of becoming your own local Evernote-esque server, right? So your Synology acts as the server. They already have an iOS out for it, which is better. QNAP has had Notes Station for a while. They have no iOS app. It is all web-based. But, I do a lot of the things with Notes. I've been a Yojimbo user for a long time, but Yojimbo just really doesn't work on the iPhone or iPad. Yes, you can sync to the iPad, but it's sort of a one-way thing, and it's not really functional. It's functional in that it syncs one way, but it doesn't allow you to edit notes. So Yojimbo basically I use for Mac Geekab stuff and legacy things that I had kept in Yojimbo for a long time. It does sync across all my Macs. But I've been using something called SimpleNote for a long time. There are iOS apps for it, and it has a very simple, easy to use web app that you can use on your Mac. And so NoteStation on Synology really appeals to me because, maybe it's the kind of thing that where I can tie all of this together. Yes, I could do this with Evernote too, and I've known that for a long time, but I'm just curious to see how NoteStation comes along. The biggest thing that I'm confused about right now is you have to log in and dig too far on the web to get there on your Mac. So I'm hoping that I'm just missing something and there's just a more direct web interface to get directly to NoteStation. Cause that would start me using it almost immediately, but it's fairly robust, especially for a 1.0. I mean, you can do all kinds of text formatting. You can add attachments. The syncing works great. I just turned it on and it was smooth, logged in with my iPhone. It's a great experience on the iPhone and the iPad. So, I throw that out there. I'm not sure if it's, the kind of thing that I'd say go dive in and do all your stuff there right now, but maybe in the next 6 months it is. And maybe even sooner than that, just as we learn more about it. But I like to see things like that. The evolution. It's good. The more I can host myself, the better, because then I don't have to deal with crazy services. And I agree with you, though. Everything needs to be backed up, which is why I run Crash Plan on the Synology, and it backs up two places. I have a subscription with Crash Plan, so it backs up to them. And then I have a Drobo at Pete's house, and so it backs up to him. It works out really well. There was another iPad app or another app that came out with iPad updates this week, John. You know which one that was?
No.
The Mac Geek Gab app is native on the iPad, which is new for us, and also native on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. So check that out. The chat interface works on the iPad. Everything works on the iPad. Corey did a great job just enhancing it out and making that work. Really, really cool stuff. And so you can obviously download the shows. You can access the chat room, which is going live all the time, because the stream is live all the time now. If the show isn't happening live, then it's just going through and rotating recent episodes. 10 most recent is what we've got it set to now. So you can always use it to just tap into the stream, or if you want to hear a specific episode, of course, it lets you do that. You can make bookmarks in the app to save things. You can provide feedback from the app, which is really cool, because we get the location and episode number, so that not your physical location, but the time location in the episode. We get a timestamp and episode number, not location information. We don't need to know where you are. So we know what the feedback is coming from. It's very cool. So go ahead and check that out. It's live in the App Store. It actually has been all week, but I wanted to make sure we mentioned it in the show here. Anything else, Mr. Braun? We've had all kinds of things to talk about. So you know, it's good. Anything? Yeah. Hello?
Well, I'll save some up. Been to some shows recently.
Okay.
A few articles about cool stuff that I've seen that gotta get up there.
Okay. Cool.
There's a few in the queue. But uh-huh. Yeah, I've been to Photo Plus. There was some neat stuff there. I was at Engadget Expand. And then next week, CES Unveiled and Wine, Dine, and Demo.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm going to join you on Tuesday or not. I'm going to see how tomorrow, being Monday, goes. And then I will make a decision. But I've basically got 2 weeks in the office, and then we're heading out at the end of Friday week. We head out for a week away. We're doing a cruise over Thanksgiving this year. So we'll probably let's definitely plan to do a Cool Stuff Found episode on the Sunday after Thanksgiving, because I won't be back until late that Saturday night. So Cool Stuff Found will be perfect. And I wanted to throw out a couple of things. We had listener Ken, who was asking what RSS readers you folks use, or we use. And I'm sort of in limbo with that right now too. I used to use NetNewsWire, but you know, that's been sort of going crazy. And now, at least I think the person who was developing it now has moved on and gotten a job at Apple. So that's probably going to stop, or has stopped. So I'm curious what RSS readers you use, both on your Macs and on your iOS devices, and if you sync them. I asked Adam Christensen, and I know he's using some apps that all sync with Feedly, Feedly. So I'm curious what you folks use. So we'll talk about that in an upcoming show. Send in your answers about that. And I'm also curious what apps you like to use when traveling, and if there's specifically any apps you like to use on cruise ships. I used to use Starry Skies on the ship to see constellations and all that good stuff, because you can use that even without a data connection. Right. And I typically don't. In fact, I've never gotten a data connection on board the cruise ship. You can. And they've actually gotten quite fast. But I like to take a week away, so I typically don't want to connect and check in with the world. But I'm sure there's all kinds of fun apps that I can use. So that would be another fun conversation for us to have. So if there's anything else, and even, you know, Starry Skies has been transitioned. Tim DeBenedictis sold it off and is not developing that anymore. So I'm curious, not Starry Skies, Sky Safari was Tim's thing. So I'm curious what you use to identify constellations these days. I'd love to hear about that. And if it's working well with the 6 Plus and all that good stuff. So anything like that would be fun. Anything else, John, before we bid adieu for yet another fantastic week?
Nope. Keep your eye on Mac Observer.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Few articles about some of the neat things that I've seen as of late.
Sweet. I'm looking forward to that, man.
Throw in Dig Reader, just while we're in.
What are you going to throw in?
Dig Reader is one that looks like it has an iOS client.
Dig?
Yeah, D-I-G-G.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't tried their iOS client. I've used that some.
Okay.
But let me find it. I'll throw it on the show note there.
Okay, great. So that's not just for the website Dig, but somehow related to that. Yeah. It's just a generic reader. Yeah, a reader of sorts. All right, sweet. That's great. Sweet. All right. Well, you can email us. You know what, John? Actually, I'm going to fade out the band here quickly because I do have one comment I wanted to play here, John, because this is very, very important.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Thad in Hawaii, and I just wanted to give you a useless but interesting piece of trivia. The shortest word in the English language that contains the letters A, B, C, D, E, and F is feedback. Enjoy your day. Don't get caught. Aloha.
That's right. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com is the address that you could send things to and use all of those letters, but just not in their alphabetical order. That's right.
Really, Dave? I don't know if I quite heard him. Did he say feedback@MacGeekGab.com?
He did. He used the first six letters of the alphabet and called it feedback@MacGeekGab.com. Also, premium@MacGeekGab.com. For those of you that are premium members, we certainly appreciate your support, and we'd love to hear from you. And we do prioritize that address, though. We do try and often, almost always, succeed in getting through everything, which is a good thing. Google Plus is where you folks have found the Mac Geek Gab community. It's growing like crazy over there. So MacGeekGab.com/Google Plus will get you there. That's the easiest way to find it. But of course, once you're there, you can join the community and then it just becomes part of your Google Plus experience. And we'd love to see you there. Great. Not only are you answering questions and we're answering them, but you're asking questions and you're answering them. It's a great community. And when I'm traveling and I don't get in for a couple of days, I check in and I see, oh, everything's been taken care of. All is well with the world. So you really have impressed me with the community there, and it's really fantastic and it's growing really, really, really quickly. So I encourage you to join. It's the best community we've ever found for Mac Geek Gab. I still have visions of developing our own system so we can do away with email and everything and just post all the questions somewhere that everyone can see. And we're going to work on that. That's part of the 2015 plan, but certainly for now and perhaps for long-term, Google Plus is the place to visit. John, what about the phone number?
Last I checked, Dave, the phone number is 206-666-GEEK, which is also
4-3-3-5. Indeed. We want to thank Michael Johnston. He converts the show from its raw form into the chapterized, link-loved, beautiful enhanced format that so many of you enjoy that is available in the app. It takes Michael usually about a day or maybe sometimes two to convert that. So if you don't want to wait for it to appear in the app and you want to get it and get the show immediately, you can turn that off in the app in the settings. But I know a lot of you really, really like the chapters and it is worth waiting a little bit for. Thank you, Michael, so much. Michael is the host of the iOS Show podcast and also the publisher of GetAppler.com. So check those out, too. And we want to thank Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. And our sponsors this month are, of course, we want to thank Gazelle, Gazelle.com. They will buy and now sell you iOS devices. Gently use. Barebones Software at barebones.com. Smile at smilesoftware.com. Squarespace.com/NGG. And of course, we mentioned Lynda during the show, lynda.com/MGG for those 7 days, and Drobo with the coupon code MGG50 to get $50 off of the Gen 3 Drobo. I think that's going away soon, so better get that before it does. John, lasting advice.
I don't know. I don't know if I have any advice, Dave. Well, maybe I do. And I think the advice would be don't get caught.
Made up.